From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Are you talking to me? Actually, no one's talking to me on Fresh Air today because we have something very special. On today's Fresh Air, we broadcast an evening with Martin Scorsese, a question and answer session recorded last week at New York University in conjunction with a Scorsese film retrospective. We'll hear Scorsese talk about his films and the films that influenced him. Also today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the previously unreleased Live at the Five Spot featuring Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. North Korea has agreed to postpone its decision to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. North Korea had threatened to drop out of the treaty as of midnight tonight because it claims the United States has threatened it by carrying out military exercises with South Korea. North Korea has also been accused of trying to develop its own nuclear weapons program, and it's refused to let UN inspectors visit two of its nuclear sites. North Korea's decision not to withdraw from the treaty came after intense talks with U.S. negotiators at the UN. Today, the Supreme Court upheld state laws that impose added penalties on people convicted of committing hate crimes. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
At issue was the case of Todd Mitchell, a black youngster convicted of randomly selecting a white boy on the street in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and leading a gang in beating the boy up because of his race. Mitchell was convicted under a Wisconsin statute, and a jury acting under the statute imposed a maximum sentence 5 years longer than it would have otherwise because the victim had been selected because of his race. Mitchell appealed, claiming that the constitutional guarantee of free expression prevented him from being punished more because of bad motive. Today, however, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that while Mitchell could not be punished for his abstract beliefs, a trial judge has wide latitude in sentencing and can take into consideration the motive for the crime itself. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
President Clinton announced today that Walter Mondale will be his ambassador to Japan. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In a Rose Garden ceremony this morning, the president introduced his new ambassador to Japan, former vice president, former U.S. senator, and former Democratic presidential candidate Walter Mondale. In nominating Mondale, President Clinton asked him to help improve the troubled economic relations between the two countries. Mondale's nomination comes as Japan and the U.S. are beginning negotiations on what's called a new economic framework to open Japanese markets to American goods and to lower the United States' $45 billion annual trade deficit with Japan. Although Mondale is expected to win easy confirmation by the Senate, he will not be confirmed in time to travel with the president on his first trip to Japan. On July 7th, President Clinton goes to Tokyo for a meeting of the seven leading industrialized nations. At that meeting, the new Japanese-American economic framework is expected to be unveiled by President Clinton and Japanese Prime Minister Kaiichi Miyazawa. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street in response to positive news on wholesale inflation for May. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13 points to close at 3,505. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 5 points to close at 693.2. This is NPR News in Washington. The Clinton administration is reportedly looking for a way to ease William Sessions out of his position as director of the FBI. The Associated Press quoted an administration official as saying that senior Justice Department officials have decided that Sessions should be replaced. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said the agency is looking for a way to get Sessions to resign for the good of the service to avoid controversy. Sessions was severely criticized for ethical lapses in a Justice Department report issued by former Attorney General William Barr. The Bavarian state government in Germany has banned an extreme right-wing party, declaring its anti-foreigner racist platform is unconstitutional. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Bavarian police raided property of some of the estimated 35 to 40 members of the National Bloc Party, confiscating neo-Nazi propaganda and two starting pistols. The party was founded 2 years ago after the death of Germany's one-time neo-Nazi leader, Michael Kuhnen. The National Bloc is the fifth right-wing party to be banned in Germany the past 2 years. Meanwhile, there have been two more attacks against foreigners. The staircase of a refugee shelter near Darmstadt was set on fire overnight. Residents were able to put out the fire. In Sinsheim, near Stuttgart, an infant was taken to the hospital with smoke inhalation injuries after an arson attack on an apartment house with Turkish families. And in Berlin, thousands of Turkish shopkeepers today shut their stores for an hour to protest the continuing attacks against foreigners. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
The 9th International Conference on AIDS ended today in Berlin with no news of breakthroughs and ominous warnings about the spread of the disease among new groups of people. Participants said that some new AIDS drugs are closer to full-scale testing, but that the limitations of the drugs now in use are becoming more evident. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wouldn't it be great to hear Martin Scorsese talk about the films he's directed and the films he loves? Yeah, we thought so too. So last week we recorded a talk billed as An Evening with Martin Scorsese. It was presented in conjunction with a film retrospective at Lincoln Center in New York called Mean Screens, Martin Scorsese at the Movies. For over a decade, Scorsese has been involved in restoring and re-releasing some of the films he loves. Several of them can be seen, with introductions by Scorsese, on Cinemax in a new monthly series called Martin Scorsese Presents. June's feature, Wages of Fear, airs again Saturday. Scorsese's own films include Mean Streets, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Taxi Driver, New York, New York, The Last Waltz, Raging Bull, The King of Comedy, The Color of Money, The Last Temptation of Christ, Goodfellas, and Cape Fear. The talk we're about to hear was recorded last Friday at NYU, presented by their Department of Cinema Studies at the Tisch School of the Arts. It was moderated by the department chair, William Simon. The audience was invited to submit written questions. Here's Scorsese responding to a question about how his movies have reworked film genres.
Taxi Driver was something we were talking about, film noir, the film noir made after the war, the darkness that came in to the soul of this country after World War II, and how it revealed itself in these films, films which were influenced by Germans and French, I think, German filmmakers, you know. And what we did with the Taxi, I said, it should be New York Gothic, I said, you know. It's like a gothic horror film, only it's New York. And it's a cabbie. That could be rough, you know. And understandably, too, because De Niro drove a cab for a couple of nights, took a couple of weeks, and I sat in the cab with him a couple of times. It's really it's a hell of a job. I mean, God, it's awful. In terms of getting in and then a person telling you where to go, you don't know where you're going. The person behind you controls your existence for the next hour, next half hour. Anything could happen. And it's really Paul Schrader's thing, Paul Schrader's script, but and his vision. But the style of it was certainly influenced by a sort of pushing forward of the film noir, is what we were trying for. And then, of course, I went further with it in New York, New York, which was, again, after the war, there were American musical comedies that were made before the war in the 30s, and then, of course, in 1944, you had Vincent Minnelli do Meet Me in St. Louis, where it changed the form of the musical film, where instead of the Rodgers and Astaire pictures, where you would have the wonderful Gershwin songs and they'd sing, and there was boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, in Meet Me in St. Louis, the songs came out of the characters and they progressed the plot and the emotions of the people, and it became part of it became a very new way of doing musicals. And after the war, however, you still had these beautiful splashy Technicolor pictures, but some of them were kind of strange, like one called My Dream Is Yours, with Doris Day and Jack Carson and Lee Bowman. And she loves Lee Bowman, but he's a cad. He wears a terrific a white dinner jacket with a black belt. He looks great. And Jack Carson wears the same jacket, but he's always heavy. And I always liked Jack Carson because he was so likable as a character actor. He loves her, but she doesn't care for him at all. She likes Lee Bowman, who's a cad. And basically, it's these undercurrents of people in show business, of people trying to entertain, of people trying to express themselves artistically. And you have these strange undercurrents of something not being right with their personal lives. What are they trying to tell us? But they try everything. They try everything. They even have a stupid dream sequence where Jack Carson and Doris Day are dressed up as the Easter Bunny. I said, what were they thinking? They were trying to still make it a musical. Come and enjoy yourselves. In the meantime, they're punching you under the table, like, you know. It's like, that's not good, boy, you know. This is going to be a problem for her when she marries this guy, you know. That, oh, jeez. I said, what was this? What is this all about? And that's only one of them. Actually, it's a pretty good film. It's directed by Michael Curtiz in beautiful Technicolor. And then there was, well, I think you really hit the stride when you do, when you have Judy Garland, James Mason's version of, George Cukor's version of Star is Born, 1954, 55. That's the real level I thought I was trying to reach and try to revise that for the 70s in New York, New York. And what I tried to do there was to have, and this is where it comes in very clearly, the improvisatory style in the foreground and the old studio style in the background. The background, however, consisted of sets that had to be built. When you build a set, it costs money. And I didn't realize when I went out to LA to do the picture, I was living in LA for a few years, and I had the thought, it's a funny thing, of course, because I guess you're young, you think nothing fades and nothing goes away. And so I still thought that a lot of these sets existed, and these negatives were fine, and things like that. So I got there, and I said, well, isn't that the old MGM set for the train and the beginning of the bandwagon and all that? It's falling apart. I said, yeah, that's the only thing that exists now. And there were only a few other places. And so we had to build these sets, and that cost money. So the problem was then, waiting for us to get the inspiration for improvisation and adding to scenes when we had all that money being thrown into the actual production. And when, in the opening of the picture, when there's an improvisation where he's trying to pick a date, have a date with Liza Minnelli in the film, we worked on that scene for 1 week with 1,000 extras each day. And that's when it started to go wrong. Because the money started to pile up. And I kept saying, yeah, but we're getting something good. And we were getting some interesting things. However, what I'm trying to say is that you had a situation where one style, the improvisatory style, is very often better controlled in a lower budget. Every time a set was built, that was the only scene that we had to shoot. In other words, you could not go somewhere else and shoot because it wasn't built. So we were improvising in this one scene, and the set was ready for us to move into the next week, but we improvised ourselves into a situation where we couldn't go to that set. And so it became a great difficult learning lesson for us, because it was a matter of controlling the improvisation to the point of literally, and you get down to basics, you sit in a room, you say, okay, now what's the picture about? And what are the scenes about? And I knew what it was about. There was a combination of these, the pushing it forward into the 70s and bringing the undercurrents that were in those films of the musicals with the strange undercurrents of personal problems and bringing that in the foreground to make it grow with what was happening in the country. But the way I went about it was not the most scientific way. And then after that, we were able to do with Raging Bull to come back and do it properly, I think, you know, in terms of improvisation.
And then we have a question here about storyboarding. And I mean, I think it's fairly well known that at a certain point that you used to storyboard entire pictures in great detail. And I guess the question here is do you still continue to do that, and does storyboarding play a part in writing the script and so on? And I guess, I mean, if I could add one other aspect to that, since you've been talking a lot about improvisation, is that there seems to me to be a tension between, on the one hand, a great deal of pre-production planning through storyboarding, but then a major sort of use of improvisation.
What happens,
how do those relate
to
each
other? Well, what happens, for example, I mean, I had to storyboard. I guess it goes right back to the years when I was younger, when I was just doing these little drawings in a room by myself, and I guess I have to go back to that. There's no doubt I storyboarded everything, and a lot of it has to do with storyboarding for economic reasons. Because you didn't have the money to shoot. You didn't have the money to get there and not know what you were going to do. You had to have a plan. I had to have a plan. Now, there are a lot of other people who don't do that. And, I mean, Fellini doesn't do it. And I understand Lynch does not do it either. I mean, goes and they work. Bertolucci doesn't do it. Gets there and they work it out. Benjamin Storaro, they work it out. Some of the most beautiful stuff ever filmed. It depends on the temperament. I just think that for me, everything that I imagine in my head as images that move and intercut together and to create a certain feeling, that's the way to shoot that scene. Now, the dialogue scenes sometimes do not take that same, it doesn't fall into the same law. So that, for example, you can have a scene in Goodfellas. Now, Goodfellas, the script of Goodfellas written by myself and Nick Pileggi, pretty much in the script, everything was almost like being in a storyboard. I have since after Raging Bull and King of Comedy, I've stopped doing all the pictures. I just do small pictures on the side of the script now. After Hours, I started doing that. There's lots of pictures on the sides of the script, and my director of photography, Michael Baldhaus, would transfer the pictures and Xeroxes, and then write them out and figure out what to do with them. And in terms of like how to shoot this particular one, what piece of equipment to use, etc. And in Goodfellas, the script was written that way, so that I didn't have to do the drawings. It's almost like documentary, where at one point he robs Air France, I think it is, for some money, and he brings the money to Paulie, and Paulie says, "Hey, don't spend that money all in one place." You cut close-up money going down to a table, money being picked up, check, all of that. In other words, we didn't sit in the editing room and say, "Oh, gee, we need a close-up of the money," you know. No, he just told him, don't spend all in one place, he's spending it. You know, it's like throwing the money. That's the idea. And so the whole script was like that. But when you get a scene that was improvised with Joe Pesci saying, "What are you laughing? What do you think I'm funny? Why do you think I'm funny?" Now, you can't draw. I mean, that's not drawn, but I must tell you, what that is, there's two cameras. I'm Joe, he's Ray. There's two cameras here, one this way, one this way, shooting me. And it's not a close-up. We didn't do the scene 10 times, going medium, wide first, and wide, then tighter. It stayed in two frames, and the two frames are important because you have Joe, and you have guys around him, and you have Ray, and you have guys around him, and you have to see the reaction of what it does to the people in the room. You got to feel how those guys start to, you know, he's only. Don't ask. He can talk for himself. You have to see that. You have to see that the mood change on everybody. Because if you go into close-ups, you may be getting like an intense thing. It becomes not truthful, I felt. And so that kind of thing, you know, you draw a picture, you say, "Oh, it's got to have so-and-so. We're going to have to, you know, just set up the two cameras this way so we can get them two medium shots," which goes right back to like the kind of American framing I used to love in Howard Hawks pictures. He's got like 10 people in the frame all the time. If you ever look at Red River and The Thing, look at the movie The Thing that he produced. I mean, or Only Angels Have Wings. I mean, it's amazing. But of course, at that time, there was no small screen video, so that image was projected, and you would see their faces, even though it was from the below the knees up, you'd see the expression of their face. So on TV, it's a little hard now. But that kind of thinking has to go into a scene like that. Otherwise, you'd be there, and you do it in the cutting. And when you do some things in the cutting, sometimes, unfortunately, it becomes selecting, not directing. And that's a problem. Everybody falls into it. Sometimes you shoot something a certain way, and you think it's going to work this way, and then suddenly you find yourself going into the outs. And, oh, she turns here. Quick, put it over here. Oh, great. Okay, that matches. Now, I mean, that happens, you know. But it's something Andre Dutat said to me. He says, a lot of people these days are becoming selectors. They put 10 cameras down, and then they go in the editing room, and it becomes, the image. That one looks good. Put it this way. There's one guy who does that, though, but he's certainly a director. It's Kurosawa. They asked him, "How did you shoot his battle scenes?" He says, "One take." I said, "Really?" He said, "9 cameras." Sets it up all day. And these guys, and I know this, I found out the secret. When we were out there in Japan, he told me, he said he has 20 horsemen. He says, he calls them his 20 horsemen. These are guys who've been with him like for 25 years. They do all the stunts in the foreground. They take care of him. They set up, they work out the shot with his nephew, Mike Inouye, who is one of the producers, and his Saito, the cameraman. They work it out, they know it, and then they call him to come from the house. It's okay. Now you can come down. And then he lays it all together, but it's a matter of getting the light in the right position. That's why he doesn't have to wait there. He's 83 years old, he's still directing.
We're listening to a talk by film director Martin Scorsese, recorded last week at New York University. Time for a break. This is Fresh Air. We're departing from our usual interview format today to feature a talk recorded last week by Martin Scorsese at New York University. The moderator for this Q&A session was William Simon, chair of the Cinema Studies Department.
One of the ways that you've talked about your own career sometimes is the need to, in order to make the personal films, that you sometimes also need to make the commercial films.
Yeah.
Is that still the case, or how do, in the current industry, is that still a situation?
In the 70s, we tried, as I said, with Taxi Driver and Alice's Liver Anymore to make, or even Mean Streets to a certain extent. I was so glad when Warner Brothers bought it, because it was the place that made the greatest gangster films. And Mean Streets has that kind of lineage, in a way. But it was not really a gangster, it was something, it was a, more of a personal statement. But I was interested in the 70s of making films that that came out of the genre, commercial genres, and we were trying to revise them. I remember Francis Coppola yelling at me and George Lucas about, you can't revise that stuff. He said, Boxcar Bertha, you can't, don't try to change the endings the way they, he said, no, the good guy has to win this. People expect a certain kind of thing in a mythic film, where you have mythic characters, they expect certain things. And you have to give it to them, you have to deliver. And George was trying to do something, it was before American Graffiti. And he said, it doesn't work when you do that sort of thing. And in some cases, he was quite right. But by the time I did Raging Bull, I didn't care what it was. I didn't care. I really thought that it was the end of my career, basically. I was going to go to Italy and make films, 16-millimeter films about saints. I thought, they all laugh at me, but that's what I was going to do. I was talking, we were doing research, and because it was really Rye Television at the time, was doing some really good films, and Bertolucci was working on television, Ermanno Olmi and Francesco Rossi, all these guys, and I was sort of inspired by the Rossellini films, and I said, well, let's just do that. And I didn't understand, you know, what was happening. I really never had a good business sense about that sort of thing. But when I did Raging Bull, I just threw it all in there and figured we'd leave. I did eventually wind up moving out of California and stayed in New York in the past decade. But after that, things changed radically. And in the case, for example, of getting Last Temptation of Christ made, I had to promise I'd do a mainstream film for them. And for Universal. And it became Cape Fear. And it was as close as to a mainstream picture I could get, I thought. But the thing was, again, there are major challenges to try to deal with the thriller elements, and also a remake. You know, it's a remake. You gotta be very, very careful when you deal with that kind of thing. After Hours was a picture I tried to get myself sort of back into fighting shape in a way, which was to do a film at the age of 40 that I did at the age of 30. And that is, you know, shoot 40 days, 40 nights, running around, do it for $4.5 million all in, including your salary, which was hardly anything, and try to, at that time, because the 80s, America in the 80s, making certain kinds of films, there was the films that were like, you know, the Spielberg Lucas things, which were so, making so much money. It was the mega hits. And here I made a picture called King of Comedy, which closed in 4 weeks, you know. So after that, I tried to do Last Temptation of Christ, and the plug was pulled about 4 weeks before we started shooting. And then I realized we couldn't get anything made that I wanted to get made. And so I came across this idea called, which became After Hours, and worked on that and did kind of a low-budget film again and tried to stay alive creatively. And then that led to fairly well, and that led to a more commercial project, where, again, where I was trying the same kind of thing within a more mainstream framework, and that was The Color of Money, in which we were able to do a picture with those movie stars coming in $1 million under budget. And then after that, it was a matter of literally being able to make Last Temptation of Christ, but again for a price, $7 million, all in. That's salaries for everybody and everything else. And shooting in North Africa for $7 million is not bad, but it was certainly, I'll never forget the surrounding of the temple. I had five guys from Rome, five stuntmen, and they had Roman costumes on, Roman soldier costumes, right? And I had to, there was a trouble in the temple, whatever, and they look up, they hear a sound, they look up, and Roman soldiers come up, and then Roman soldiers come up, more Roman soldiers, and more over here. Well, I had five guys. Wow. The trick was to learn, again, go back. The whole picture was storyboarded because we had no time for anything. We had no time to breathe, to get there. And by the time we got to the location, too, this was out in the desert in places, you know? And so I realized it was the old, you know, I drew the shots, and I figured, okay, I know what I have to do. But when I was doing it, I was just, oh, it was so painful. But I said, all right, this is it. Five of them come up here, flash pan. Cut, same five guys. That's it. And then they had to fight the Levite guards. And they became the Levite guards on reverses. I'm not kidding. And I said, I can't believe what we're doing. I said, if I hadn't studied Roger Corman pictures, you would never be able to do this. But I mean, they were the same, the Levite guards. I couldn't believe it. I said, for the reverse, now we got, and they were all yelling in Italian and it was the most despairing moment. And I had just read the reviews for Empire of the Sun and The Last Emperor. They sent Time magazine. I said, oh, beautiful, we're gonna see the film. But look, they had, oh, look at all the extras he had. Oh, oh, what have I done? I said, maybe I was just too eager to do it. Maybe I should have waited. And Michael Ball, I said, Marty, they're never going to give you that kind of extra for this picture. Let's shoot. Come on, get up. Come on, let's go. And it was hysterical. If you look at the temple scene, every shot, they're the same guys. Every now and then we change a helmet. But the tricky one was the Levites. That was, oh, man. So it's that kind of thing. And I was able then, what do we do after that, Thelma? Goodfellas? Oh, New York's, well, Goodfellas, the major feature. Oh, Life Lessons, yeah. And that was something that was Woody Allen's idea he liked the old Italian films and French films of the early 60s, that they were a series of short stories. And like Boccaccio 70 and pictures like that. And so he had originally talked to me, and then Francis did it. And that was something that had been worked on for a long time. That we had more leeway. We had $5 million to do that. And that was only a 40-minute film. See. And then Goodfellas. And Goodfellas was, again, one for me, in a sense. And after that, we had to do the one for them in terms of for Cape Fear. And I don't say that in terms of excusing anything. That's a certain reality. And when I get myself involved in those situations, I try to learn as much as I can from the choice that I make. And I must tell you, Cape Fear was a very hard picture to make, and it was also the first film I used widescreen anamorphic lenses, and I learned how to work with boats, and of course, it's a very difficult thing to do, and storyboarded the entire picture, pretty much the entire, especially the boat sequence at the end. It's the first time I used a storyboard artist, but I worked with my own drawings first, and it took about 3 weeks for him to make the same kind of drawings, 200 shots, just for that sequence alone. So, you know, it became quite a job on that. And what are we doing now? Age of Innocence. Age of Innocence. I know you wanted to ask me about what Age of Innocence. Age of Innocence. Innocence is something I've been wanting to do for Jay Cox. My old friend gave me the book 10 years ago, or more than that, 1980, 13 years ago, and I read it about 7 years ago. You know, and it takes me a long time to sort of gestate these things. What I'm trying these days to do is to do a lot of reading if I can, but I grew up on visual images, not books. And I saw movies and television shows and movies on TV, and there were no books in the house, really. It was the Daily News and the Daily Mirror. And I never read those, so, you know, and basically, I became exposed to visual literacy, I think. And these days, it's really fun to discover some authors and try to read the books and try to find the time to read the books, you know. In this case, Edith Wharton, The Age of Innocence. And so I wound up with, Jay gave me this book. He said, I know this is you, he said, when the time comes. And if you want to do a period piece. And so we wound up. Finally, I think the film was commissioned by Fox, and then it went to Columbia Pictures when we were finishing Cape Fear. And it's kind of a departure, I think, and I've tried to utilize the same film language within a period setting, and as far as the themes are concerned and things like that, I mean, I can't really talk about that now, but the idea is a picture. It's really a picture that I wanted to make for many years, and we were lucky that Columbia Pictures gave us the money and the time to finish it properly.
Martin Scorsese recorded last week at New York University in conjunction with a Scorsese film retrospective sponsored by NYU's Cinema Studies Department and the Film Society of Lincoln Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll hear more from Martin Scorsese on the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more with director Martin Scorsese. Last week, an audience at New York University had the rare opportunity to ask the director about his work. We'll hear part two of that question and answer session. It was given in conjunction with a retrospective of Scorsese's films at Lincoln Center. Also, a recording of a legendary jazz session has just been released. Kevin Whitehead reviews Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane live at the Five Spot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At the urging of international mediators for the former Yugoslavia, presidents of Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia have agreed to meet in Geneva next week. They are to talk about the worsening situation in the three-way conflict in the region. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade.
EC mediator Lord Owen made the announcement here after a second round of talks with Serbian President Slobodan Milošević. He and the UN mediator Thorvald Stoltenberg said the meeting between Milošević, Croatia's Franjo Tuđman, and Bosnia's Alija Izetbegović would focus on increased fighting in central Bosnia between Croats and Muslims and on rising tensions between Croatia and rebel Serbs who occupy one-third of its territory. Lord Owen said, "It is a new situation we are facing in the last few weeks. There is a very marked deterioration on the ground. Today, British peacekeepers escorting a Muslim convoy killed two Bosnian Croat fighters who attacked the trucks. It was the first time UN soldiers killed combatants in the 15-month Bosnian war." This is Sylvia Pajoli in Belgrade.
In a move that clearly pleased Tokyo, President Clinton has nominated former Vice President Walter Mondale to be ambassador to Japan. At a Rose Garden ceremony, Mr. Clinton said that Mondale is a leader of wisdom, courage, and stature who can help improve economic relations with Tokyo. Last year, the U.S. trade deficit with Japan was nearly $50 billion, or nearly two-thirds of the nation's total trade deficit. Mondale said that each of the two nations has a vital stake in the other's economy. Demonstrators in southeast Cambodia are threatening to become more violent if members of the UN peacekeeping mission do not leave the country immediately. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead has more on the story.
About 150 demonstrators gathered this morning outside the UN provincial headquarters in the southeastern provincial capital, Sphai Ring. They demanded that members of the UN peacekeeping mission leave the province immediately. They smashed the windows of a dozen UN vehicles and said if all UN personnel weren't gone by tomorrow, they'd come back and burn the vehicles. Sphai Ring is one of at least three provinces in eastern and southeastern Cambodia where disgruntled government officials are said to be leading a secessionist movement. They have seized control of the ferry crossings linking Phnom Penh with those areas and are not letting UN vehicles on the ferries. Many UN officials feel the whole thing is pageantry, an attempt by the incumbent regime to jockey for power after having lost last month's UN-organized elections. But they acknowledge even staged events can quickly get out of hand. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Phnom Penh.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 13 points to close at 3,505.01 on volume of more than 253 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. According to Russian officials, Moscow is agreeable to sending peacekeeping troops to Bosnia if approval is given by the UN. Russia's foreign minister told a NATO meeting today in Athens that his nation needed a clear definition of what Russian troops would be doing in Bosnia. There are now some 900 Russian soldiers in peacekeeping efforts in Croatia. At 2 days of meetings in Athens, NATO allies agreed to join in defending UN peacekeepers with their air power, and the U.S. offered to send several hundred soldiers to Macedonia to keep the fighting in Bosnia from spreading. The 9th International Conference on AIDS ended on a sobering note today. Despite a growing worldwide awareness of AIDS, the epidemic continues to spread. NPR's Joe Palca reports in Berlin.
There wasn't very much good news from this year's AIDS conference. According to the World Health Organization's Lars Callings, the epidemic is staying ahead of efforts to slow it down.
News of this conference is that the epidemic is still on the rise, especially in many developing countries.
Cowling says the research presented at this year's meeting makes it clear that it will be some time before an effective vaccine or therapy will be ready. In the meantime, Cowling says the only way to stop the epidemic is by preventing the spread of the virus. He says there are prevention programs that work, and it's time for the world to make sure these programs reach those at highest risk of getting the disease. It's now clear this group includes women and adolescents, especially in developing countries, as well as intravenous drug users and homosexual men. In Berlin, I'm Joe Palka reporting.
Also in Berlin, Turkish shopkeepers closed for 1 hour today in a demonstration against anti-foreign violence in Germany. Hundreds of people took part in a noontime rally to demonstrate the importance of Turkish workers to Germany's economy. One spokesman for an immigrants group said that nearly 2 million Turkish residents of Germany should withdraw their bank money for a day to show their economic power. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're doing something different on Fresh Air today. We're featuring a presentation by the great film director, Martin Scorsese. Last Friday, we recorded an evening with Martin Scorsese, held at New York University, in conjunction with a retrospective of his films and films he loves at Lincoln Center. The evening was a question-and-answer session moderated by William Simon, chair of the Cinema Studies Department at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts.
Can we talk about popular music in your films a bit? I mean, one of the senses that I get is that you most likely have a sort of history and theory of the meaning of popular music, at least from the end of World War II, that you use it especially to create setting and a sense of period and so on. Use it a lot. So
one thing I don't want to do is to use it to create period and setting. I use it because I like the music.
Okay.
And the music gives me certain feelings when I hear certain specific songs or certain pieces. And I think that one of the reasons was because growing up, my mother always had the radio on, and I remember Bing Crosby and incredible voice of Bing Crosby. And my father had some 78s that he had bought, and a lot of them were Crosby and a number of others, Benny Goodman and different things like that. But also, especially a French jazz group, Django Reinhardt was a great guitarist, and Stefan Grappelli on violin, called the Hot Club of France, the quintet of the Hot Club of France. And I used to listen to those records, and the improvisations were so, they were like, I don't know, they created images in my head of a kind of, almost like a painting in a way. And I would imagine images from this music constantly, and it's one of the reasons I made New York, New York. We use one of the songs in the film. And over the years then, that was in the late 40s, then the early 50s, again hearing the top 40 songs of the period. A top 40 song reminds me of a certain time and a place, but it had, while the music was playing, other things were going on. And when I was down the Lower East Side on Elizabeth Street, I'd look out the window, and at the time rock and roll began, or came out, like Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, that sort of thing. You know, it was a block away from the Bowery, and you'd see derelicts, you see the life of the derelict and everything else. In the meantime, a jukebox is playing My Blue Heaven with Fats Domino. And it had its own irony, maybe too much of an irony, but it had a rhythm to it and a move to it that was, I began to score my own life in a way. Music was always playing, scoring my life. And then when you hit 1961 or so, and you have Phil Spector's Wall of Sound, I don't think I've ever gotten out of those 3 years. Those 3 years, every song by the Ronettes or the Shirelles or whatever, you know, all the girl groups of that period. Again, we use it in Goodfellas when they go through the Copa. We use one of them, Then He Kissed Me, I think, is the song. And there was a sound, the sound that he created, that wall of sound, and what it brings to mind of my growing up and where I was at the time and what it was going on when I heard certain songs like that in a bar or in a nightclub or in these after-hour places that all the kids had at times, like 4 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday and Saturday night, very strange. And that music was really scoring a lot of things that certainly didn't call for that kind of music, you know. And so that's the way I imagined it. I imagined all of the pictures, and the first one to really break that, again, it was an underground film, quote unquote, was Kenneth Anger's Scorpio Rising. And when they came on and you hear Ricky Nelson singing Fools Rush In, and then, you know, Little Peggy March, I'll Follow Him, and Wipeout, and these images of the American death cult, the whole idea of motorcycles and death heads, and juxtaposed with images of religious imagery and James Dean and this whole thing. I don't know what the hell it was, but it was sure as hell powerful. And I said, this is it, of course. I said, why don't you just... You see, at the time, I was a film student. They told us we couldn't use the music because we had to pay for it on film. But, you know, we couldn't pay. Who could pay at that time that kind of money? So when we were able to do the first feature that came out of this university, Who's That Knocking at My Door, I was able to make a few deals with some of these guys. And there were only about three or four or five pieces of music that I wanted, that I could have had much more, but I wanted the film to be released. And I shouldn't have worried about that. I should have just put the other pieces of music that I wanted. And eventually, I was able to put all the music I wanted into Mean Streets, as much as possible, and into Raging Bull. But the idea of it was that I felt I could have more fun with my own scores in a way. And then sort of breaking up the music, and I think you see a lot of it in Goodfellas, where he's driving around, he's trying to make the sauce and trying to deliver the drugs and the guns, and the helicopters are after him. And there's one scene where we use three pieces of music, one right after the other. A performance, Mick Jagger, and it slides into the Magic Bus, the Who live at Leeds, and then some other group. And all switching around as if he's hearing it in his head. And I was trying to give the impression of what it really would be like for people who've never been under the influence of something, of a drug of that kind, to experience the panic and the paranoia, for good reason, too, this guy, at that time. For good reason. But did he have to pay as much attention to the sauce as he did for the guns in the helicopter? Come on. That's where the drug got him, you see. And the undoing, you know.
We're listening to a talk by film director Martin Scorsese, recorded last week at New York University. Time for a break. This is Fresh Air.
When Wilbur will call, and even his night, I hurry to my blue heaven. You turn to the right, you find a little bright light that leads you to my blue heaven.
We're departing from our usual interview format today to feature a talk recorded last week by Martin Scorsese at New York University. The moderator was William Simon.
You've been very active in film preservation, and I wonder if you want to talk about the reasons for that and some of your beliefs.
Well, part of it was very selfish. When I realized back in 1975 or 6 that when we started to do New York, that the sets wouldn't last, and well, that I kind of knew, but then I tried to seek out the old three-strip Technicolor camera to get that effect of Technicolor in New York, the way they had in the old musicals, and I discovered that wasn't around anymore. And then I was watching a film which I love Visconti films, Luchino Visconti, and The Leopard was the picture that I really liked a lot. I first saw it, I was a film student here, and I wrote a report on it, and I wasn't too impressed by it. And then over the years, I saw it a few more times on television, cropped and dubbed, and it's got to be really interesting. And then over the years, I tried to rent copies of it. And the rentals we began getting in the mid-70s, late 70s, were anamorphic. They were widescreen, but they were pure pink, magenta. They were gone. The image was gone, pretty much. And what you start to lose, not only do you lose the color, of course, but people say, well, the color fades, so what? Well, you lose the eyes of the actor, you lose the emotion. You don't know, they've sort of blended into the sky. You can't see the delineation of the way people are structured in the frame, how people move, what they're doing. In any event, what had happened, it was the mid-70s, late 70s, Ron Haver, who just unfortunately died, had a remarkable show of films of 20th Century Fox at the Los Angeles County Museum. And when it hit 1953, the films were beautiful. They were incredible 35mm prints from the studio. They were three-strip Technicolor, black and white, gorgeous. And then when it hit 1953, I'll never forget, it was the night we went there to see Niagara and Seven-Year Itch. And Niagara came on. It was gorgeous. You know, beautiful print. Very interesting movie. Joseph Cotten, great. She's great. Beautiful color. And then Ron came out and he talked. He said, now look, excuse me. And apparently this had happened a week before. He said, look, The Seven-Year Itch, the print is faded, okay? I didn't know what he meant. Everybody started going, oh, like that. And he said, what we're going to try to do, he said, is we have a filter in front of the lens upstairs, up in this, and then people start getting more angry. He goes, no, I know, it'll go out of focus. If it goes out of focus, we'll take the filter down. And this is just to see, this is a museum. This is Hollywood. This is a place where they can go and get the studio print. And this is the studio print of 70 Rich. So I was with Jay Cox, and I said, Jay, well, do you want to stay? He said, well, let's see what it is, you know. And there it is, beautiful, widescreen, stereophonic sound, pink and blue, the whole film. And then they put the filter in front and to try to make the color come up. And then it started to melt, of course. And everybody started screaming, we had to leave. Right, they took the filter off and they watched the film pink and blue. And I said, what is happening? You know, and then, of course, I discovered all the things about Eastman color and that sort of stuff, where Eastman color was cheaper to do. And I would go about a long roundabout way. And so to cut it down somehow, I realized, making New York, New York, the futility of the whole thing, because the prints of the film, let alone, I don't even know, I was afraid to even think of what would happen to the negative if it wasn't stored properly, but the prints would fade, you know, 10 years, 12 years, that's it, to pink or blue. Blue first, then pink and magenta. And then that led to the decision to make Raging Bull in black and white, because the designing of New York, New York took so much out of us. The designing of the look of their faces, they had to look like three-strip Technicolor, so we put rouge in the faces, we put lipstick on the men to have that richness. We exaggerated all the colors so that hopefully that it would give the impression of the old color of the Hollywood and the Hollywood movies. And of course, a few years later on TV, you know, it looks like hell and it looked pretty bad. And so I said, well, the next one we'll do black and white. And there were other reasons for doing Raging Bull in black and white. There were four other boxing films coming out in color. Rocky III, I think, or Rocky II, The Main Event, and Matilda, the boxing kangaroo. And I said, I think it's going to be really interesting we do this black, and they're not going to expect it. And actually, it was Gene Kirkwood walked by. He said, don't forget Sweet Smell of Success, he said. Alexander McKendrick, don't forget that. I said, oh, yeah, he's right. He's right, black and white, beautiful James Wong Howe photography, New York, you know? And so we combined all of that and used Raging Bull, did it in black and white because of that. And at the end of Raging Bull, myself and Thelma, my editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, we sort of had a, we attacked Eastman Kodak Company and used the, with a letter, and we sent around to all the filmmakers and film archivists and actors and directors of photography around the world, explaining what the reality of the negatives were and the reality of these prints were. And basically, they all signed a petition, and we got quite a response. There's quite a group of people who signed. And we used the European tour of the opening of Raging Bull to go around and present a 3 or 4 hour show explaining what the deterioration of the film situation is right now. And in Tokyo and Berlin and Venice, and two in London, and one in New York and one in Los Angeles. And by the end of that, we met with Eastman Kodak, and by the end of that, by 1982, 83, they had changed their film stock to, for no extra cost either, they had changed it to what they call a low-fade stock. So everything that's made from 1983, 84 on is in pretty good condition. They claim, and it looks very good, the stock. I mean, they claim it'll last anywhere from 40 to 80 years in the right conditions. The color, just the color. And they really came a long way, and since then, we've been very close with them, working out new things, new ideas. In fact, I have a very big film collection. Most of it's housed now. A lot of it's housed up at Eastman House with their help. And at the same time, we just began to realize not only was color fading, but the images were gone. The films were fading. The films were going. They were deteriorating. And this began around 86, 87, where I started to go into the studios and was able to speak to the studio heads, because usually I was working out a deal with them on a picture or something. And I would bring in this point about, listen, you know, you have about 250 incredible films in that vault. What's happened to them, et cetera? And with this communication, which was one-on-one with most of the studio heads, we're able to form a group called the Film Foundation in 1990, which is sort of a liaison between the archives and the studios. And they're restoring films now. It obviously has become something that's... now the 100th year, the 100th anniversary of movies, and I always say it's the American art form. It was really developed here, I think. The use of montage, Edwin S. Porter to Griffith, et cetera. It's the American art form, and it would be a shame for the custodians, even though they own it. I tell the studio people that you may own it, I said, but basically you're still really a custodian because it belongs to all the people. You know, you definitely own it. If you really own it, number one, take care of them because you can make money from it. Number two, you're really a person who's, when they say years later, why didn't they do something about it? We are they. I said, me and you, you know? In any event, a lot of stuff is really being put together. There are only a couple of places that, because of some, you know, the way things, companies fold, and you don't know who's watching, who's minding the store kind of thing, and it's very hard to talk to anybody there about, they don't even know what film they're making next, and to talk about preservation of the old films, it's a very hard thing. But Universal, Paramount's doing a great job, Columbia doing a great job, Fox, and Warner Brothers, all doing pretty good.
Martin Scorsese, recorded last week at New York University. Our thanks to Martin Scorsese, Elizabeth Petit, NYU Cinema Studies Department, and the Film Society of Lincoln Center. The film series Mean Screens, Martin Scorsese at the Movies, continues through June 27th at Lincoln Center. And this month, Cinemax began the series Martin Scorsese Presents. Tomorrow on Cinemax, he presents the film Wages of Fear. Scorsese's talk was recorded for Fresh Air by David Gorin. This is Fresh Air. Lots of Supreme Court news today. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we're going to be hearing from Nina Totenberg about two decisions announced by the court today. One of them is about hate crimes. That is, the question was, can a state, in this case Wisconsin, say that certain kinds of assaults are punishable by longer jail sentences because they were accompanied by various bigoted epithets? And the answer was yes. Also, the court ruled that it's all right to slaughter chickens in Santeria, that is, in keeping with certain religious rituals, you can have animal sacrifices. And we'll also be hearing from Nina, by the way, about where President Clinton is headed with his choice for the Supreme Court. Earlier in the week, she said it was Bruce Babbitt, but now she says he's headed toward Stephen Breyer.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In 1957, a little jazz club called the Five Spot on the Bowery at 4th Street in New York City hosted a legendary five-month engagement by pianist Thelonious Monk with John Coltrane on tenor saxophone. Monk and Coltrane had recorded a few tunes together in the studio, but no live tapes from the Five Spot had ever been issued until now. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
That's Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane at the Five Spot in 1957 from a new CD on Blue Note. The release of these live recordings by two of jazz's greatest musicians is a big deal. Coltrane often spoke of how important playing with Monk was to his development, both rhythmically and in terms of what the saxophone can do. But some jazz record buyers will be unimpressed, specifically those weirdos known as audiophiles, people who don't care how good or bad music is as long as it's recorded well. This music doesn't qualify. It was taped by Coltrane's wife, Naima, using one microphone and a portable recorder. Admittedly, this sound is pretty foggy, but a lot of great jazz exists only in low-fidelity form. Besides, it doesn't take long for your ear to adjust, so you can hear why Coltrane found the gig so valuable. The key lessons master musicians impart to younger players are often about rhythm. Coltrane could work out his complex approach to harmony while practicing on his own, but the subtleties of rhythm and ensemble interaction Monk personified could only be learned on the bandstand. On a splendid version of Monk's theme, Epistrophe, the quartet treats Latin rhythms in the same quirky and blocked-off way that Monk deals with the rhythmic quality we call swing.
¶¶
there's some confusion about who the drummer in this quartet is. The producer of the CD somehow determined it's Roy Haynes, although neither Haynes nor anyone else remembers him playing with this band. And it doesn't sound much like Haynes when he recorded with Monk at the Five Spot the following year. More likely, it's the quartet's regular drummer, Shadow Wilson. Whoever it is, he's cooking. Listen to how the drums and Monk's piano punctuate Coltrane's tenor solo on Epistrophe. Coltrane builds tension by rushing ahead. Monk does it by holding back. One nice thing about this recording is you can still hear the bass, played by Ahmed Abdul Malik. He was hired by the Termini brothers, who ran the Five Spot, after they got tired of bassist Wilbur Ware, who was Monk's choice, hitting up the customers for drug money all the time. The parts Abdul Malik plays are most always springy and tuneful, though he's not ranked among the great jazz bassists. The late 50s was the golden age of jazz bass playing. Technical standards were high, bass players knew their job was to swing and not to show off, and they hadn't yet started using amplifiers, arguably the worst thing to happen to jazz in 30 years. Bass amps just give drummers an excuse to play louder. Now, modern bass players will tell you they have to use amplifiers to be heard, but as this record shows, that's bunk. The natural woody tone of acoustic bass is beautiful, and the sound of amplified bass is ugly, so why do we have to put up with it? Ban the bass amp now. As you can tell from this lousy recording, back in the 50s, folks really cared about sound.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic living in New York. He writes for Pulse and CD Review. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Our intern is Devin Reif. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Lonnie Guinier's writings were considered so controversial that President Clinton withdrew her nomination for the head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. What exactly did she write? We'll talk with Guinier about her writing on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.